This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Dire forecasts dominated New Hampshire news early in the week. A blizzard of epic proportions was feared, and Granite Staters were urged to hunker down. But while the snow did materialize, in terms of severe impacts like traffic accidents or power outages, the state emerged pretty well. PSNH spokesman Martin Murray says that's due in part to the perfect type of snow that fell.
A unique consistency. It's really like ice crystals. I think if you're a downhill or Nordic skier, you're going to have a blast later this week once the snow dies down, the wind dies down, because it's just wonderful powdery snow.
Apart from one snow day, New Hampshire lawmakers kicked into major work mode this week with bills galore. Republican Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley has a proposal to eliminate permits for concealed carry of firearms. Bradley calls it a modest change.
We're not expanding in any way who can own a firearm, nor are we expanding the types of firearms that people can own. It merely allows somebody who has the right already to openly carry a weapon to do so on a concealed basis.
Also at the State House, debate occurred on a measure to forbid welfare recipients from using their EBT cards at certain establishments like tattoo parlors. Mary Lou Beaver, director of Every Child Matters, spoke at that hearing.
While we may not fully agree with you on the need for this legislation, we believe that what is proposed is fair and does not create additional burdens for those in need, those that run the programs, or the businesses that serve them.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Dave Brooks is here, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua and moderator of the Nashua Science Cafe. And Dave, great to see you. Thank you for being here.
You bet.
Also with us, Kevin Landergan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News. And Kevin, busy week with all the storm coverage. We appreciate you being here.
Great to be back, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, real quick about the storm. Dave Brooks, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. It was big, but it didn't seem terrible.
It was great. It was absolutely a terrific storm.
A
perfect storm in the good way instead of the bad way. And for the reasons that, that the quote you had earlier, it was a very kind of dry snow. I did a melt test at my house. I only got about 14 inches because I live a little bit too far west to get the big storm. So I had 14 inches and it melted down to 1. So it was about 14 to 1 ratio. So in other words, 14 inches of snow melted down to 1 inch of water.
So that's a dry snow.
That's dry. Normal is about 8 to 1 to 10 to 1. So what that means is even though you had large piles of white stuff, they didn't weigh as much. So there weren't any roof collapses. And of course, because they were dry, they didn't stick to the trees and knock the trees down and kill the power.
Somebody was joking they could use their leaf blower to get rid of it.
I was absolutely doing with a broom. The flip side of that was the whiteout, because it was so light it was blowing around. I was driving around, as we all were, doing stories during the storm, and the whiteout was so bad, A, there was nobody on the road, But the whiteout was so bad, I wasn't quite sure where I was. And I suddenly realized I was on DW Highway South, which is the divided highway that road in South Nashua that leads to the Pheasant Lane Mall. Usually has, you know, 20,000 cars. It was me and nobody else. And I suddenly realized I was driving south in the northbound lane. I didn't even know.
Ooh, Dave, that's scary. Wow.
Well, it was kind of entertaining. And I suddenly looked up, and the stoplights were facing the wrong way.
Wow. And Kevin Landrigan, yes. From the TV side of this, I mean, everybody is glued to the television. What's the storm going to do? Forecasters, not necessarily in this area, but more in the New York area, are getting some flack for predicting Armageddon for New York City. Can you just sort that out for us? How you guys approach this story of wanting to tell people, look, please stay home, please stay off the roads, but it's not going to be Armageddon?
Yeah, it's really it is a balancing act you do, particularly in broadcast media. You want to alert the public. You don't want to alarm the public. I think that's the watchword, if you would. We did 17 hours of continuous coverage on this blizzard at NH1. We saw it as kind of as a new media company, kind of a dry run for us. And our chief meteorologist, Clayton Stiver, as soon as we went on the air at 8 a.m., was the first to report that the track of this storm had changed somewhat and the severity of the storm had been reduced to, as David said, down to the southern tier, that whole band from, say, Nashua all the way to Kingston. That's where the jackpot was. Atkinson, 29 inches. Nashua, 33 inches.
Wow, inches. That's a lot of snow.
That's a lot of snow.
The most since 1888, most ever. 1888 was 30 inches. That was the previous record.
Okay. Yeah, and what's interesting is that Governor Maggie Hassan, kind of in true New Hampshire fashion, refused to impose a travel ban. Looked pretty good with regard to that, because by 4 o'clock, three New England governors who had had travel bans had taken them away. Now, why don't we need a travel ban? Because New Hampshire's used to that, and its people are you primarily use common sense. A perfect illustration of that was, for the first time in anyone's memory, there were no tolls on the turnpikes. Because of the state government being shut down, except for the essential service to fight the storm, all the toll takers were given the day off. On a typical day through the tolls, you have about 80,000 to 90,000 people go through the tolls. During the storm day, only 11,000 went through those booths. So obviously,
and how many of those were plow trucks, too?
Exactly.
10,999.
Right. Okay. And very quickly, since Kevin mentioned Governor Hassan, Dean, got to turn to you on the politics of this, especially around New England.
Yeah, I mean, history is littered with the careers of politicians who have not prepared adequately for storms. And so, you know, we used to commend Governor Lynch for wearing the gubernatorial windbreaker well, or the parka in the winter. Governor Hassan has continued that tradition. She was seen many times on TV in the Emergency Operations Center, seeming to be in control of things. She did a nice job, a nice call on that travel ban. She got on the right side of it. You have to be careful. You know, down in New York, Mayor de Blasio said this will be like no storm you've ever seen before. You got a little bit of ribbing for that. But, you know, the retort is, well, better safe than sorry. So it was an early test also for Governor Baker in Massachusetts, Mayor Walsh. Generally, everybody getting good reviews. But as I said, you mess up one of these storms and your political career is often short-lived.
All right. Well, after one short snow day, the legislature got down into big business. And Kevin Landrigan, I was saying earlier this morning to Rick Ganley that it's hard to know which bills to talk about because there are a lot there. But let's pick a couple. One that got a lot of attention, Kevin, is Senator Jeb Bradley's bill to eliminate the permit to carry concealed weapons. What's the thinking behind this?
Yeah, the state of Vermont hasn't had a permit to carry a concealed weapon for 220 years and has a lower crime rate than New Hampshire does. Actually, it's the safest state in the nation. By the way, we're the sixth safest state in the nation, so even with this permit to carry. This is a philosophical debate, essentially. We're a very pro-Second Amendment state. We have one of the top three memberships per capita in the National Rifle Association. Conservative legislators have been trying for years to get rid of this permit to carry. They say it takes up to 2 weeks to get this permit from local chiefs. What really has raised the ire of folks in the gun rights advocacy movement is a New Hampshire Supreme Court decision in 2013, which essentially gave chiefs even broader latitude to define what is a suitable person who can receive that permit. Gun rights advocates think some chiefs have abused that, so they want to get rid of this permit.
Well, we got a couple comments, a lot of comments actually on our Facebook page about this, and I can't read all of them, but thanks to everybody who commented. James says there are other states that have this, such as Vermont, Alaska, Arizona, Wyoming. James says, as a neighbor of Vermont, do we see all the doom and gloom that people here think will happen if we remove this law? Is Vermont really that dangerous a place to visit? John says criminals aren't going to be applying for gun permits anyway. So instead of taking up time, which costs taxpayer money, why don't we take the money and invest it in improving mental health services and other neglected social programs? So there's James and John saying they're fine with getting rid of this permit. Then here's Matthew. He says, as a gun owner and concealed weapons carrier, I believe this would be a very bad idea. He says it's important for the local police, who presumably know the citizens in their community, to have input toward who should be able to carry concealed. He goes on to say, I work with acute psychiatric patients, and a percentage of them are not felons, but they would still pose a threat to community. So that's Matthew. And then finally, Gunnar says, no way. How is this making New Hampshire safer? There's some commentary from our Facebook page. Really, Dean Spiliotis, we've gone over these kinds of issues before here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, there's just this is working on two levels. One level is there's just a fundamental debate between gun rights activists and gun control activists about whether or not we would be a safer society if more people were able to carry concealed weapons. And that's just an ongoing debate. It's been going on for decades. I don't know that there's ever going to be an answer to that. The second debate is over, infringement of constitutional rights to bear arms. You know, the political dimension of this is it may very well pass the Republican legislature here. Maggie Hassan has said she, quote, shares the concern of law enforcement, which is usually sort of an early hint that that perhaps she will veto it. I think politically she likes having the support of law enforcement. But it's all a debate about whether or not we have a constitutional right to carry guns in any way that we determine, and whether or not that makes us a safer society. And the sides on both sides are incredibly entrenched. It just has turned out that the gun rights advocates have generally been better at organizing politically. They've been more focused and effective.
Well, one more quick topic that I wanted to ask you guys about before we head into a break. And Dave Brooks, there was a bill proposed this week to require auto inspections once every 2 years instead of every year. This is something almost everybody has to do because almost everybody in New Hampshire has a car. What do you think of this?
Well, you know, I used to live in Tennessee back when they did not require any inspections at all. And it was a disaster. I mean, the roads were littered with auto parts and every other car was missing a headlight. But I also lived in Virginia at a time when they required inspections every 6 months. Which was also a disaster because everybody forgot about it. I don't know that going to 2 years would have a huge safety problem, but I do say that personally I like the fact that it's every year because it's on my birthday month and I remembered. If it was every other year, I'd never remember whether this was the year I have to do it or not, and I think it'd be more of a pain in the neck.
Well, lots more to talk about after break, including why the Executive Council this week approved a major contract with troubled Fairpoint Communications. We'll find out about that and cover a lot more, including the state bidding process closing this week for medical marijuana dispensaries. All that coming up, plus your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories around New Hampshire this week, including in a moment the recent signing of a major state contract with Fairpoint Communications, a company that's had a lot of trouble lately. We'll turn to that in just a moment. We're taking your questions and comments, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Kevin Landigan, I did want to ask you about a big story this week that NHPR covered, the state bidding process closing for those companies or nonprofits that may want to run medical marijuana dispensaries. Just give us a quick update there, Kevin.
Yeah, these are all nonprofit businesses. 14 applications have been accepted in all four discrete regions of the state. It's important to note that New Hampshire has not been split in even quarters here. They're trying to create four unique markets for these businesses to operate. That's why, for example, the northernmost region of the state consumes about 45% of the landmass. That's because there aren't the people aren't up there. And in order to promote businesses to go up to that northern region, they're actually cutting the license fee in half from $80,000 down to $40,000. The first license will be awarded in the southwestern part of the state, in the Keene area, and the state has already indicated that that business that's awarded may also get a license to operate in the other state, which sort of suggests to us, not that the fix is in, but rather that this has been a long time in coming. The state has had a long time to review, and it appears they have a very good idea of the companies they find who are best to do this. 21 states have medical marijuana. Many of these are national companies that operate in other states already and have very good records.
And I was looking at the DHHS requirements on their website this week, Kevin, and I was struck by the emphasis on the words charitable, nonprofit, you know, community mission. So we're using the term companies loosely, right? These are nonprofits. And why is that?
Well, essentially because, for one thing, it may be a shock to most people, but in the early stages, this is not a super profitable business. That's why you don't see private companies get in this business. And in many cases, you're dealing with a population, these medically eligible individuals who, frankly, because of their conditions, are in financial straits themselves and don't have a whole lot of money, may not have proper insurance. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, they may have insurance when they didn't have insurance for years. So these companies are going to have to set up, in many cases, kind of unique paying arrangements for folks in order to obtain that medical marijuana.
All right. So 14 people put their bids in, or 14 organizations,
yep.
And we'll see who gets that first shot at it.
Yep. Should be in late February. We'll know, and 10 days after they're selected, all the applications will be public.
Again, our number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And up first is Carl in Manchester. Hi, Carl. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, a comment on the state inspections. I had spent a few years in California, and they had inspections when you purchased the car, and that was it. And coming from New Hampshire, I've seen some pretty horrific vehicles on the road. Your steel-belted radial tires with the steel belts worn through the rubber, no fenders, windshields missing. Hard to imagine. Now, they were willing to enforce, proposing a two-year inspection package. The people I worked with were rather upset because one of them said, well, I have an emissions-tested engine that I will install every 2 years to get my car inspected. But then I will put in a different performance, non-emission qualified engine back in my car with a remainder of the 2 years.
So, Carl, make sure I got you right. So in California, they perform an inspection when you purchase the car, and that's it for the life of the car.
Originally, yes, when I was back there. But they, at the time before I left California, they did propose a two-year
Cycle, like New Hampshire. What's your take then, Carl, on New Hampshire proposing to move from every year to every other year?
I don't know that every other year would be good because in New Hampshire you have such varied weather conditions, deterioration of the car in a one-year period can be quite significant.
Okay. Carl, thanks for calling in. And, you know, it is this question Dean Spiliotis of, you know, what's safer, what's better, what's more convenient. Dave Brooks' point, well taken. You know, would you forget? There was an incident, though, in the Concord area, I think it was last year, where a piece of a truck flew off and hit this, you know, this lovely young nurse who was on her way to work, and she died instantly. And, you know, there is an argument to be made for having safe vehicles out there.
Right, absolutely. And I also, like Carl and David, previously lived in a state where there was no auto inspection. I think eventually they passed an emissions inspection. But and some of the cars that I saw on the road, you wondered how they even held together. But there is an economic dimension to this. It's very expensive to own a car and to do the proper upkeep. So you kind of want to strike a balance between not being too burdensome on residents, but at the same time ensuring safety. And that is one of the arguments, is that if you have tires falling off or, you know, pieces of the fender falling off, it is a real hazard. So you want to strike a balance. I thought it was interesting. They mentioned as kind of a financial kicker, they would double the cost of the sticker so that the state wouldn't be any loss of revenue, but but they would also save $2 million because they wouldn't have to print as many stickers. So that was another part of the economic argument.
Wow, crunching the numbers down to the last dime there. All right, well, Carl, thank you very much for calling in. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to Patty next, calling in from Exeter. Hi, Patty, you're on the exchange, the Friday News Roundup. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to mention we're one of the customers Fairpoint has not been able to take care of for several months. We haven't had our phone for over 2 months, and for 2 months before that, it was had this awful buzz on the line, and they told us to buy this little box to fix it. This lovely young man from Kentucky finally came just before the storm, fixed one of our lines by switching them over. But we found out that even though we've been calling almost daily, the trouble ticket had been closed several times without them fixing it. And then he was going to come back to finish the job, and they closed the ticket out again, so they didn't send him back.
So, Patty, let me just see if I have you right. So you have your – sounds like you have a landline with Fairpoint, and you didn't have a phone for 2 months?
Over.
How about your internet?
That's separate. We're not, thank goodness we weren't doing everything with Fairpoint.
So what's your take, Patty, on the Executive Council approving this major contract this week with Fairpoint?
Well, I guess I don't know if my take is so much on that as it is when you have when we have a system that is not truly free market, it actually helps lock in place monopolies and oligopolies. Then we need regulation of those companies because left to their own devices, they just do whatever they want.
Well, Patty, good luck, and thanks a lot for calling in. And, guys, more on this Fairpoint story. Joining us now is Jonathan Van Flee with the Concord Monitor. He's been covering this contract before the Executive Council that, as I said, was approved this week. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Laura.
So what is the contract for? For what services?
These are for telecommunication services with the state of New Hampshire. It's a $13 million contract that would go through 2020, the year 2020.
And, Jonathan, everybody knows the trouble Fairpoint's been having. We just heard from Patty, who didn't have a phone for more than 2 months. Why did the Executive Council think that this was a good choice for the state?
Well, that's a great question. I think the contract with the state, they viewed it as is separate from the service complaints, but they wanted to use the contract to leverage Fairpoint to address these complaints. It became clear that the time that it takes Fairpoint to resolve a complaint is usually about 3 to 5 days, and this is historic data. And since the strike and more recently, it's taking 2 to 3 times as long. And so it's taken, in some cases, 2 weeks more. You just heard from a caller who said it's taken months. And so the Executive Council, I think, wanted to hold back this contract and get Fairpoint to address these concerns, these complaints, and return to a state of normalcy. So if people are losing their service, they can expect to get it restored in a reasonable amount of time. Susan Hodgson, the Administrative Services Director, had said that the state wanted to do some upgrades to its lines, and not approving the contract was holding that process back. So there was some pressure to approve the contract, which is why I think they eventually went ahead with it. The contract first came up in December, and they got a concession from Fairpoint. They are now going to hold monthly public meetings to update people on the status of the service complaints.
Kevin Landrigan, hold on, Jonathan, if you could. Kevin Landrigan, did you want to jump in on this issue too?
No, I just wanted to say that Jonathan was absolutely right, that all the counselors used a lot of political pressure on Fairpoint, got Fairpoint President Patrick McHugh to come to the meeting. He's been at the last two meetings of the Executive Council on this subject to commit to that service levels are getting better, that they have more staff on right now dealing with these troubled tickets that Patty referred to than they've ever had since before the strike began. And it's absolutely true that the state, given the workforce issues and that these upgrades the state wants by July 1st, Jonathan nailed it, which is we need to approve this contract to give them that much time to deliver on the improvements in this contract. It was very competitive. Six companies came in, and several of them said they could make these upgrades quicker than July 1st. So that's what that's what put the pressure on the council to act. The council then put the pressure on Fairpoint to commit to these hearings.
Okay, and final thoughts, Jonathan, on this. What to look for as this moves forward, especially if Fairpoint keeps having trouble?
I think these public meetings, the council, and there will be considerable political pressure put on Fairpoint in the future to make sure that people are getting their service restored in a timely manner. You'll see that continuing forward.
Okay. Jonathan Van Fleet, thanks for taking time out for
thanks
us.
Thanks for having me on, and I'm happy to be on with such talented people like Dave Brooks, and Kevin Landrigan, and Dean Spiliotis.
Jonathan Van Fleet, editor for Politics and Special Projects at the Concord Monitor, also editor for PolitiFact NH. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Dave Brooks and also you, Dean Spiliotis, I did want to talk pipeline politics. And Dave Brooks, we've heard a lot on this program and others about a Kinder Morgan pipeline proposal for southern New Hampshire called the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline Project. Just remind us what the goal is. This is part of a big picture.
This is part of a big picture. Kinder Morgan is a Texas energy giant, and it's one of actually two Texas energy giants that wants to do some major expansions in, of natural gas pipelines in New England in order to bring us natural gas from the shale fields in New York State and Pennsylvania, bring those to the Boston market in New Hampshire and the rest of New England. And this, the Northeast Energy Direct, which was going to go through northern Massachusetts, and they shifted it up to southern New Hampshire. It's about 71 miles through the state. Most of that along or underneath or next to PSNH power lines, which makes it a little more tenable, frankly. They were scheduled to have a large meeting actually Tuesday in Milford at the Hampshire Hills Sports and Fitness Club, this very large facility in town that would have drawn lots of people, but that was canceled by the storm. But there still have been hearings. Merrimack Town Council had one last night. There is a lot of the opponents have formed actually a three-state opposition group called Stop NED, because Northeast Direct is NED, and that includes New York State and Massachusetts as well as New Hampshire because the pipeline does all this. And the idea basically is to go from right New York, where there currently are pipelines, to bring as much as 2 billion cubic feet of natural gas through New Hampshire to connect into Londonderry, where there are existing pipeline networks that would take it down. Gas could be used for heating and, most importantly, for electricity production.
And we keep hearing that the region needs more natural gas, that there natural gas is there for the having, Dave, but there's not enough pipeline capacity to bring it into New England. So this is part of that.
This is that. That's the whole point of it. That's why they were willing to spend $3 billion, lots of money, to make this pipeline. And there are some who argue that, you know what, $3 billion could actually be used to generate electricity in ways that would not lock us into 20, 30, 40-year contracts with this big pipeline.
Which is still a fossil fuel. Natural gas burns more cleanly,
sure.
But it's still a fossil fuel.
It is still fossil fuel, but it's our fossil fuel. We got a lot of it not very far away, so there's a lot of people who are chomping
it
a bit
wherever.
To get it.
Yeah, well, Dean Spiliotis, how are the region's governors, state lawmakers going to sort through this? I mean, it was so interesting to hear Dave talk about this big, big proposal that, you know, the energy officials anyway in New England say we need. But then you have a lot of people, this group that's forming that Dave told us about, saying, no, I don't want this thing to blow up in my backyard.
Yeah, you know, you obviously are in a situation where you're pitting communal need against individual property rights. This has been a tough issue for the region's governors. You know, we've had these energy summits in which they've gotten together and talked about the need for increased capacity for natural gas. They've talked about what to do about Northern Pass with the hydroelectric power. You know, New Hampshire has gotten a reputation as a difficult place to get these kinds of projects in place, whether you're trying to site a wind project or whether we're talking about Northern Pass or whether we're talking about this pipeline. You know, there's a tradition of property rights. So you know, the question is, what are we going to do about it? And these processes end up taking so long, years and years, because the federal process goes on and on. You're almost guaranteed lawsuits. I'm not sure. I mean, we've been studying this. We've been talking very closely about this over the last few years on the Roundup, and there's not an obvious answer. Whenever people talk alternative fuels, you get into all kinds of issues about you know, siting and permitting, et cetera. You talk about these other projects, people don't want a pipeline running underneath their property. So I'm not sure what the answer is. It's a very sticky question for the region. region's governors.
Yeah, they really have to thread the needle on these questions, yep. Don't they, Dean? Right. Well, two more stories that I definitely want to cover with you guys before we head into our second break. And Kevin Landrigan, the cuts we've discussed a couple times here at Health and Human Services generated more interest at the State House this week, specifically a cut to nursing homes. What was said at the State House this week, Kevin, on those nursing home cuts?
Yeah, Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Pappas presented to the Fiscal Committee the outline of his proposal to deal with a $58 million deficit in his budget. The deficit is primarily caused by the increase in Medicaid spending that has occurred in part because of the Affordable Care Act, but also just the notion of the Affordable Care Act actually prompted a lot of people who were eligible for Medicaid to come forward and say, yeah, I'll take the coverage. The most controversial proposal Commissioner Tumpas has is to eliminate $7 million in spending for nursing homes, both government-run, that is the counties, and also privately-run nursing homes. Senate President Chuck Morse, House Finance Chairman Neil Kirk, legislative leaders in both bodies extremely upset about this and more upset, frankly, to learn that the Attorney General is backing Nick Tumpas. Mainly, Joe Foster has indicated he has this authority to do this, to transfer money in order to balance his budget. Legislature, you gave him that authority. Keep in mind, HHS consumes more than half the state budget. So that commissioner gets kind of unique powers to deal with the moving and spending that goes around in an agency with more than 3,500 employees.
Well, and we've heard about pressure to cut HHS's budget from the governor, from the legislature. What did Commissioner Tumpas say about this to lawmakers who've told him to cut back, but just not in that way?
Right. Essentially, in the state budget, there was what they call a back-of-the-budget cut of $7 million to Health and Human Services. And this is the expense Commissioner Tumpas has said, okay, you said I've got to cut $7 million out of this budget. You didn't say where it has to come from. And Governor Maggie Hassan is another one who's in Commissioner Tumpas' corner. Keep in mind now, this essentially is when's a cut, not a cut. This is not a cut when this was actually a rate increase for nursing homes, who haven't had a rate increase in their rates for some time, who John Poria, the head of the Nursing Home Association, has said so many of these nursing homes, even the privately operated ones, are in such slim margins. They've been waiting years for this rate increase. They're not going to get it now.
Okay. Well, that's a story we're going to have to keep an eye on for sure, Kevin. We will talk more after a short break. We'll turn to another story. Presidential hopefuls gather in Iowa, and New Hampshire's Bill O'Brien joins them. Dean Spiliotis will tell us why after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, we look closer at the sharing economy with the rise of services like Uber and Airbnb. Traditional taxis and hotels are looking over their shoulders. We'll find out more Monday on The Exchange. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments on some of the stories that we're wrapping up from the week in New Hampshire News. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our callers. Colin joins us from Lancaster. Hi, Colin, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to condense the story about safety and inspections. I don't think it will make a difference between 1 year and 2 years. If somebody wants to get by the inspection system, for instance, they have a hole in their vehicle, they put a piece of tape across it, and it's as long as you don't see the ground, it passes. Hoods are not going to ever be inspected, or trunks that fly off and hit nurses. But this morning we learned on national news that people that are involved in accidents have a 30% chance of being less injured with today's safety in cars. And so I think, you know, we could go to that 2-year period.
So a vote from you, Colin, to go to the 2-year period.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I won't ask anything else on this, but just to say that this has generated a lot of interest from our listeners, a lot of people calling on this, so that's probably a show that we'll have to follow up on at a later date. Thank you very much, Colin, for your comments. And Steve's calling from Hebron. Go ahead, Steve, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to make a comment about the concealed carry issue.
Sure.
I was at the hearing yesterday. I testified because I'm a traveler. I need a concealed carry permit to be able to travel to other states. Where we do have reciprocity. There's currently 22 or 23, depending on how you count. And I testified that I was very happy to see in the bill, Senate Bill 116, that the issue of reducing it or increasing the length of time that a permit is good for from 4 to 5 years, and also to please, it also says that it will coincide with your birthday month. That's always been an issue for us people that have them all these years. Sometimes you forget 4 years. There's nothing like your birthday when you have to register your vehicle. It'd be much more convenient because when you forget and say you're driving around 2 months and you're going someplace and you just don't have your license, you think you're fine with your concealed carry revolver. Pistol license was really what it's called, that you can get stopped. You get stopped. You find yourself coughing up a ton of money for lawyers and everything else just to keep yourself out of jail just because you didn't remember it's a 4-year permit, not a 5-year permit. And I think that's very interesting to point out. Also, yesterday, I believe it was the chief of police, one of them that was there, mentioned that there's a federal law. When he was asked by Senator Cataldo, what do you do when you leave the state to get through New York and Massachusetts?
Which have tougher requirements, right, Steve?
I'm sorry?
Which have tougher requirements than New Hampshire?
Yeah, and there's a federal law, the McClure, Volkmer Act, the McClure-Volkmer Act since 1968 made provisions that you, as long as you take your revolver, pistol, lock it in a lock case, in your trunk or in a place inaccessible to the occupants of the vehicle, ammunition separate in boxes and case. You can go through any state. You cannot stop for anything but fuel, or if it's a huge state where you can't get through overnight, you can stay at motels. You cannot visit with friends or anything. Then
okay.
You're run afoul of the law. But you can stop for pit stops, food, and but keep on going until you get to a state such as Pennsylvania is the closest one to us that we have reciprocity with, and there's West Virginia.
Boy, Steve, lots of laws, and I'm sorry to cut in on you there, but Kevin is just showing me how complicated this is.
Yeah, no, there's no question it really is. One of the things the police chiefs talked about, too, was that there are federal restrictions on carrying a concealed weapon. Even in New Hampshire, if this permit is repealed, if you're a felon, you will not be able to carry a concealed weapon. If you've been committed to a mental institution, you won't be able to carry a concealed weapon. If you've been convicted of a domestic violence crime, you also won't be able to carry concealed.
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you. And again, lots of detail there. We appreciate it. And Dean Spiliotis, I did want to ask you about something that happened almost a week ago on Saturday in Iowa, a big event for Republican presidential hopefuls. Bill O'Brien was there from New Hampshire. Is former Speaker O'Brien running for president?
No, I don't think he's running for president. Progressives in New Hampshire have been having a lot of fun on Twitter with his appearance over the past week. This was the Freedom Summit in Iowa. It was sponsored by U.S. Representative Steve King, who's a very conservative Tea Party style U.S. representative, also by the Conservative Citizens United group. It was sort of a Tea Party confab. It was an opportunity for presidential contenders to speak, to address this crowd. There was a lot, as you can imagine. It was just sort of President Obama bashing festival, which is what you get in these kinds of forums. It was funny, you know, there's basically a list of presidential contenders as the speakers, and then Bill O'Brien was kind of on the end of the list. There's some speculation that maybe he was invited after he was nominated to be speaker again by the Republican caucus before he was outmaneuvered by Sean Jasper. I don't have any confirmation of that, but that's kind of kicking around the internet. You know, he spent his time speaking, taking shots at Jeb Bush over Common Core curriculum. He took shots at Mitt Romney for being a two-time loser, said we don't need to nominate a two-time loser a third time. You know, his argument all along, as is the case with a lot of these other conservatives, is that the Republican Party needs to nominate an ideologically consistent conservative rather than a moderate or a rhino Republican in name only. So
Bill O'Brien's a perfect person to make that case.
And it's interesting. You know, I remember back when he was Speaker of the House, I noticed, and I had never seen this before, that a lot of the stuff that he did in the state legislature and the House was also kind of percolating nationally among Tea Party groups. So there was almost not overt coordination, but it was kind of the first time that I've ever seen sort of a national ideological movement move in tandem with what was going on in the state legislature. And he was really kind of at the center of that. So, you know, he's well known nationally. New Hampshire's the first in the nation. He's certainly outspoken. Yeah. So it was, you know, it was fun to see him up there along with, you know, Sarah Palin and a number of the other Republican contenders. But he took his shots at Romney and Bush and made the case for a conservative nominee.
Well, from politics, where it's hard to find agreement, to something that happened this week that made everybody go, "Ah, Dave Brooks, a rare woodpecker was sighted." It looks absolutely beautiful.
It is absolutely beautiful, and I wish I'd seen it. It's a sign of how the wildlife in New Hampshire is shifting a bit as part of, frankly, climate change and other issues, and you can no longer count on what you're going to see the way you used to be able to.
It's I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's a red-headed woodpecker. It's got sort of a checkerboard body. Kevin Landrigan, can you help me out with this?
Yeah, it's got a very red-headed redhead, as the name suggests, very black, inky black wings, but a checkerboarded body. It's very striking. New Hampshire is kind of woodpecker country. I mean, we have downy woodpeckers. We have a variety of sapsuckers that are in the woodpecker family, woody-haired woodpeckers.
There really is a woody
woodpecker? There really is a woody-haired woodpecker that's got kind of plumage on top of its head. But this red-headed woodpecker is, as Dave said, is I think the first sighting in Durham some weeks ago was the first time ever. So it's a pretty unique event. The Audubon folks are very excited about it. And Dave's right. I mean, you look at the weekly bird sighting columns that get written in the papers, and Audubon puts it on their website, and it's very striking to see the list. You often see species that you've never seen there before. This isn't the first time.
Well, speaking of seeing things, Dave Brooks and Dean Spiliosa, I want to ask you this too. New Hampshire Fish and Game had something to say, Dave, this week about the use of high-tech hunting equipment that allows you to really hone in and track animals from way far away and super easily. High-tech rifles, drones, and who knows what else.
Yeah, it was, they were talking about technology, but the debate really is about the soul of hunting. Is it, you know, the journey that matters or the arrival? As the Fish and Game chief said, talked about the principle of fair chase. If you think that hunting is just out to kill whatever you can kill as quickly and efficiently as possible, then it makes sense to allow, you know, infrared heat-seeking drones or whatever. But if you actually think that hunting is a way to get in touch with the environment, frankly, and kind of a test of people, then this technology does not make sense. And that certainly is Fish and Game's point of view. And I think most hunters would agree with that. And there's a reason why. So, for example, the archery and the muzzle loading seasons have grown so much in the past 10 years, even though they're much harder to do. It's very hard to kill a white-tailed deer with a bow and arrow. But that's what a lot of people do, because hunting is not just out there to kill something quickly. It's out there to become, frankly, part of the environment.
The tracking,
the knowing where you're going, why you're going, where the animals are going to be, what the weather's going to do, what the hill is like. I mean, hunters really, you know, I'm a you know, I'm a crunchy granola tree hugger kind of guy, but hunters know vastly more about the New Hampshire environment than I do because they are really out there and they really have to know it to be a hunter.
Well, this question of should drones and live game cameras be banned for New Hampshire's hunters that Fish and Game is looking at, I think generated more Facebook comments than anything else. So I won't share all of them. But here's Sarah. She says, yes, they should. If a hunter is not skilled enough to be a hunter, they should not hunt. William said, I don't see a real issue with it, honestly. There's nothing less sporting about tracking an animal's movement remotely. It's not like they're using a jaw trap to hold them there. It's passive technology. Bob says, is it legal? Is it safe? Is it ethical? Was it a fair chase? If yes to all, pull trigger. Seems like this could possibly violate fair chase. And then Stephen says, completely unsporting. Hunters already use plenty of unfair advantages. We've got to set a cap somewhere. Thanks to everybody for those comments on our Facebook page. Dean Spiliotis, did you want to jump in on that a little bit?
Yeah, this is interesting to me. I'm not a hunter, but I have a couple close friends who are avid hunters and have been their whole lives. These smart rifles are fascinating to me. These basically are rifles that have built-in Wi-Fi technology so that they can account for, you know, things like wind speed, a movement of an animal. Apparently, they can hit an animal that's moving at 30 miles an hour. I mean, it kind of takes the challenge out of it. You know, this idea of fair chase and sportsmanship. But, you know, there's really no end to what you can do with technology. And actually, it will then fire automatically. You don't even have to decide when to fire. And the other thing is drones. I just find the issue of drones endlessly fascinating. You know, they actually had to say there's a ban on drones at the Super Bowl. They don't want people bringing their drones to the Super Bowl. You know, drones for hunting. There was just a drone that crashed in the White House lawn.
Right.
This is crazy. These things have tremendous application. If you've ever seen a video shot with a drone, it's a beautiful thing. You see a lot of views that you would not normally see unless you had a helicopter. So there's a lot of benefit, but the technology is showing up in these surprising ways, like hunting, where it really fundamentally changes the exercise.
Yeah. Well, so Fish and Game, I guess, is going to have to vote on this at some point. All right. Well, and speaking of high-tech viewing, very quickly, Dave Brooks, you cover BAE Systems at times because they're big business your neck of the woods down in the Southern Tier. New visionware from BAE Systems that might allow you to see, I don't know, as far away as Superman,
well,
maybe?
It is kind of astonishing. So basically, it's gone from 17 micron to 12 micron. There you go. A micron being a millionth of a millimeter. It's kind of a definition of resolution. And they've developed the first application, a 12 micron application for sights. And their first product they're selling it as a sight for weaponry. So basically put it on a gun so to help, you know, the American snipers out there snipe. It can see through smoke. It can see a moving. It can differentiate friend and from foe, they say, as far away as a couple of kilometers. Really an incredible technology. It's so incredible, in fact, that it's right now it's covered by export laws. You know, it can't be exported. It can't be given to sort of a non-military or security markets, although hunters would love to get it.
Bird watchers. We talked about that beautiful woodpecker earlier.
Absolutely. And it's an example. So BAE is actually they've built an entire factory down in Hudson to help develop this because they really think it's going to be quite a market for them. But it's an example of how even when you sell to the government as a military suppliers do, you still have to keep improving your technology and you have to keep one step ahead of the market.
Well, gentlemen, as we close out the show, I always like to ask you guys what you're up to next week and let everybody know. Of course, we've got 5 live shows, as always, next week. But one in particular that I want to highlight is we're going to be looking at the challenges of grand families. While grandparents have always helped out with their grandchildren, more and more of these older people now find themselves the primary caregivers for their grandkids. It's a tough situation, and we're going to find out more next week. Kevin Landergan, I'd love to turn to you first because there's so much happening at the State House. I just wonder how you're going to pick and choose what you're going to cover over there, and give us a little preview, please.
Yeah, it's really difficult. There's a lot of legislation in the next couple of weeks. We have abortion rights legislation, more gun legislation, but at the end of the day, it's all about the almighty dollar. We've got a serious financial problem with this state. We've got fewer than 5 months now to fix it by June 30th, a deficit of at least $30 million.
That's so for this budget year, never
this,
mind the new
that's
one
for
that
this
we're going
budget
to be
year.
Into.
So frankly, I'm watching January revenues very closely. That'll be coming out at the first of the week. The other thing about money that is very important to the state of New Hampshire is the federal budget. President Obama proposes his federal budget on Monday. He's talking about $75 billion in additional spending. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure he's not going to get most of that, if not all of that, from a Republican Congress now that is in control. But when you have a state in New Hampshire, 58% of its budget is federal money. When anybody in Washington starts talking about sending more of it out, New Hampshire lawmakers become very interested.
Now, that's really interesting. So even though we focus so much on this program, on the state budget and what the Senate's doing, what the governor's doing, what the House is doing, you're saying follow the real money, follow the federal budget, because almost 60%, you said 58,
yes.
So almost 60 comes from the federal government. So that's the budget to watch.
That's right. And that's why when they talked about not getting rid of Medi-Scam, but scaling back on our Medicaid enhancement tax and forced by a lawsuit now with the next budget, for example, for the next 2 years, got to deal with $50 million less.
All right. Very interesting, Kevin. Thank you. And Dean, how about you? What are you going to be watching?
Well, we're only 2 weeks away from the governor having to present her budget, so a lot going on with that. And then, of course, you know, it's presidential primary season, full tilt. I think it was John DeStazo at the New Hampshire Journal who had a list of every potential candidate who said they will be here in the next 2 months, and it was either 10 or 12 people. So there's just a lot going on for people who are into the presidential primary.
Do you have plans to have sit-downs with any of these folks?
Yeah, we're in the process of scheduling some. We had one scheduled with George Pataki, but that was canceled by the former New York governor. Was canceled by the snowstorm.
Okay. We'll keep an eye on that. How about you, Dave Brooks? What are you going to be tracking next week?
Measles, sort of. The measles outbreak at Disneyland. So I was just looking briefly into the situation in New Hampshire, where we have had one case of measles in the last 5 years. There is a political aspect to this, because there is actually a fight over establishing a vaccine directory that will be coming up in the State House.
Okay. Very interesting. Guys, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The
Exchange is a production of NHPR. I'm Laura Knoy.